Well, do you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you everybody for coming. My name is Pierre Morin. I'm originally from Switzerland. I'm gonna facilitate this evening tonight. And first of all, I wanna welcome you all to the Process Work Institute. Thank you for coming on a Sunday, on a rainy Sunday evening. It's a lot. And I also wanna welcome Isabel Asafar and Ben, who's have volunteered to share some of their experiences around that topic, and I'm going to introduce them a little bit more in details. I want to share my vision, why I had this idea to organize this meeting. And the vision for me is to have this meeting and maybe later on, well, in January, have a larger open forum where I would then invite also more people from the community to participate to address this issue on health equity and diversity. I have a background in medicine, so I was trained as a medical doctor, and in medical school, we never really learn much about the social aspects of medicine. I mean, that was 25 years ago. Maybe a few things have changed since then, but I still think it's a marginalized topic in medicine. I'm also passionate. I've studied psychology and studied process work, which is a method of psychotherapy and group facilitation, which really inspired me because it gives me hope that we can address some of the issues on a community level using some facilitation skills and some group processing skills that I will introduce you to some of it with a video. So what I have planned for tonight is that I'm showing first a brief 5-minute introduction to the topic from this PBS series on natural causes, and then that maybe Ben Asafar and Isabel might share some of their experiences around that issue of health diversity and health equity from their personal experience. And after that, I will show you a brief sequence on process work facilitation skills and process work methods in conflict facilitation. And then together we might be able then to discuss and go deeper into the issues and see where we go as a group, questions, or maybe even discussing the topic together as a group. Does that make sense? Great. So now I'm going to introduce you a little bit. I know all of you, and I've been working with all of you in several capacities. Ben Duncan is, I don't know what exactly how you define your role.
You might it varies.
You might not want to talk about that. Oh, well, we have a microphone. We are using microphones. We are using microphone because we are recording it for people to listen to it from a distance afterwards. Oh. So maybe if you use a microphone.
Thank you. Is this going good?
Yeah.
So as Pierre mentioned, Ben Duncan, my title is health educator with Multnomah County Health Department. And it was interesting, actually, as Pierre was kind of talking about his path from kind of the medical standpoint to now looking at some of the social standpoints, I kind of did the opposite, where I'm finally starting to learn more of the epidemiology and other aspects of the health field, but really was hired initially as a community organizer So my real background is around environmental justice and community mobilization and activism. And so this really excites me, these kind of conversations, starting to look at how these two fields, you know, assuming that community organizing is a field, seeing how they intersect and how we can expand the conversation, particularly as it relates to public health, around how we stop looking just at individual behavior and individual disease intervention and start looking at kind of the social determinants of health. And I'm sure we'll have, you know, the video does a great job of talking about that, but also I'm sure we can have a great discussion about that as we move forward.
That's great. And both Ben and I are on an advisory committee together. I think that's where we met. We are both on an advisory committee for a community-based health project, the Josiah Hill Healthy Homes Initiative, which in the Cully neighborhood is working with Somali and Latino families around issues of environmental health, especially asthma and other environmental toxins. And Asafaj and I are working at Lutheran Community Services. Asafaj is a mental health counselor for Somali families in the community, in the larger Portland metropolitan area. Maybe you want to say more.
My name is Asafaj Mendes. I'm originally from Ethiopia. I've been here since I was 17, which was a couple of years ago. Tonight, as I'm listening to what Pierre asked me, I was interested in finding out exactly what he wanted me to share, and I'm just going to share from my personal experience as an immigrant coming from Ethiopia, rather than specifically talking about the clients I've been serving. I do work with currently a lot of the immigrant refugee communities from Africa, predominantly from the Somali Bantu and Ethiopian families. But as we go along, I'll be sharing more about my own personal experience in terms of the acculturation issues, adjustment and transitional issues, which is really a journey from the 70s up to now, and it continues. So it is something that I have a lot of information about on a personal level that I would be willing to share with you.
Thank you. That's great. And also, Isabel Soule is an assistant professor at the OHSU School of Nursing, and we've been working together trying to bridge nursing training with community issues and bringing nursing students in contact with different communities in the Portland area. And we've been working, and some of you are here, one of the students that are currently in this semester working together with me and Isabel on these community issues. You might want to say.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Ben, I've heard your name all over. Nice to meet you. Good key informant interview for you nursing students. I spent the first 20-plus years of my career inside of a hospital, and I believe that I was always a community health nurse and didn't know it. So I am just at the beginning of a whole new transformation about understanding the complexity of public health and community health. Being in a hospital in intensive care is simple compared to the hairball of public health outside. I'm a lover of travel, have worked abroad not nearly enough. So I'm currently working with refugees and immigrants here in Portland. Worked for many years in the Latino community, which I love, and working more predominantly with the African community now. Recognizing the complexity of social determinants of health, and again, my background's also pretty pathophysiologic in terms of a disease model and so on, which is a real mismatch to many of the communities we work with. And I was also driven originally by an individualistic perspective. You choose to smoke and you're choosing this and this. when the lives of our community members are just so much more complicated than that. So it's a humbling experience. I have barely touched the surface, and I look forward to more on that.
Great. So maybe let's watch this 5 minutes introduction to the course, and then we continue. Is that okay?
Great. Let's see, it should work.
I need my glasses to look at the things. It's not okay. It has to be play. Oh, well, if it's upside down, I can't really read. If it's upside down, I would just have to play. Man, it is placed up. Play.
I think if you hit that one, the one in the middle.
Yeah, that's what I tried.
Yeah.
Here we go.
There's one view of us as biological creatures, that we are determined by our genes, that what we see in our biology is somehow innately us because of who we were born to be. What that misses is that we grow up and develop. We grow up as children, we grow up as adults and continue. We interact constantly with the world in which we are engaged. That's the way in which our biology actually happens. We carry our history in our bodies. How could we not?
Should be a ticket to good health. We have the highest gross national product in the world.
I'm very happy to finally have some of my cars in one location, some of them.
We spend $2 trillion per year on medical care. That's nearly half of all the health dollars spent in the world. But we've seen our statistics. We live shorter, often sicker lives than in any other industrialized country. We rank 30th in life expectancy.
Especially of economically developed countries, we are at the bottom of the list.
A higher percentage of our babies die in their first year of life than in Malta, Slovenia, Cyprus. How can this be? Is this just because 47 million of us have no health insurance?
Healthcare can deal with the diseases and illnesses, but a lack of healthcare is not the cause of illness and disease. It is like saying, since aspirin cures a fever, that the lack of aspirin must be the cause of the fever.
Or is it mostly because of our American diet and personal health behaviors?
Those behaviors themselves, in part, determined by economic status. And so our ability to avoid smoking and eat a healthy diet depends, in turn, on our access to income, education, and what we call the social determinants of health.
But wouldn't our genes trump social determinants of health?
Among twins who live together until age 18, who basically grew up in the same households, so had at least a relatively similar exposure. If they diverged later in life, if one became professional and the other was working class, they ended up with different health status as adults. This is among identical twins.
Written into our bodies is a lifetime of experience, shaped by social conditions and policies that can determine who will be sicker, who will die sooner.
there are ways in which our society is organized that are bad for our health. And there's no doubt that we could reconfigure ourselves in ways that would benefit our health.
There are huge inequalities in the society. All this wealth is maldistributed.
Pet food, ice for the pets, water.
And I think that's in part why the U.S. as a whole has relatively poor health amongst the rich countries, and why even the better off people are suffering. And we think that that is not inevitable.
That's pretty powerful in itself. So how about we just maybe, who wants to start sharing some of their experiences and things, and we go on from there? I don't know, I'm looking at Asafar, I don't know why I'm looking at you.
Oops. Easy target.
Are you?
Oh, you want me to? Actually, this is fine.
Makes a lot of
I see.
It's on.
Okay. You hear it? My ears are very small, so it might fall. It is powerful, isn't it? For me, as I think about my years in this country, when I first came, I remember just the barrage of questions that people had about where I came from and, you know, how I got here. How did you get here? And I, you know, always like to make fun of things, and I usually say, well, you know, I flew with you. How did you fly? And people have this vision of Africa that we all lived in one, this, you know, like, big jungle, and we're swinging from one tree to the next, and I kind of took advantage of that and told a lot of jokes about that, except I forget to tell people that I was just joking, and they believed it for the most part. So, you know, I handled those kinds of questions with humor. I didn't think that it was necessarily directed to me. It was just lack of knowledge, information, and those issues I had to push away to deal with my survival in terms of coming here. And as I went along with more things that come up in terms of the social issues of being part of a culture that is new to me, and along with that, in 1974, there was a revolution in Ethiopia, and I couldn't go back home. Families were just dispersed. So there's all of that additional information that I had to process, and you know, you just have to focus and start thinking about, okay, how I move from day to day in terms of how I live, where I live, you know, the issue of education, going back, you know, going to school and not being able to get money from your home. So all of these things really create this tremendous stress that you have to stuff and not deal with. But you move on every single day and year from year, and you graduate, you get your degrees, and you get married, you have children. And then things happen. Those things that happen are the thing. For example, I was in a serious car accident in 2003, and unbeknownst to me, a lot of stuff that I have never dealt with just came to surface at that point in time in terms of just the underlying issues of the tremendous stress that you go through, just adjustment, acculturation, and, you know, the issue of really being abandoned by your home, which kind of moved on to a different direction, and all of those things as somebody who's, you know, trying to survive in a new culture that for you, you think you've dealt with it, and you really haven't. And so it just becomes an added what's the right word? dilemma. That's a good word. That at this point in time, when you have, you know, you've come to a level in terms of your education, you've got your master's, you're a family therapist, you've got a business going on, you've got two children, one going off to college, one in high school, and of course, you know, the life issues of, you know, being divorced and all of these things that you think, you know, how did I do all of these things and manage? And yet when there's a bump, that you just come back to a point where you think, oh, there's so many things I haven't dealt with in terms of, you know, where I'm living. It wasn't as healthy as I thought it was. In 1988, I had a very close friend of ours who was killed by the skinheads in Southeast Portland. And I've lived with it. It's like, oh, yeah, happened. And you just have to move so quickly and so... you just don't have time to deal with that. It's a huge thing. And I didn't think about that until just I had the time to be, when stuff happened in your life, you just stop and think, oh, that was so unhealthy for me not to have dealt with that. There's a very close friend of mine who got killed. And, you know, I remember all of those emotions that I just stuffed. And I still think, you know, I'm quite healthy and I can impart a lot of wellness to my clients. That's a very interesting point to think about. How much of the wellness do I think I have? You know, except the process of really understanding that I have moved from point A to point B, that you can do that too. But the critical thing is how well are we as a community and as individuals that are imparting wellness to other people, because we're all affected in the same, we're all in the same place. Here I am from East Africa. You know, it was not by design that I ended up here. I don't know. But it is interesting that I've become a native Oregonian for all practical purposes. And yet I am from a very different place, a very, very different place that has a lot of history and wisdom, and I would be very willing to share that with my community here in Portland. Questions?
Well, I just want to have a reaction, and first to thanks for sharing so personally. And you mentioned a lot of quite intense topics that I just want to acknowledge. Skinhead, racism, someone being killed, friend, the challenge of immigrating and how all this, it's I just want to acknowledge that.
Thank you.
Yes. Yes. And maybe we will be able to go deeper into some of these issues together. But I just want to acknowledge that in the moment. Thanks.
Thanks, Peter.
Do we? Maybe Isabel, do you want to continue? Yes.
One thing that came up to me is how we carry culture in our bodies, in our physiologic bodies. And how I think as a healthcare provider, how we often don't assess that. About these unfinished issues, their own individuals' own connection to their own countries, their own families that have really been demolished in pretty traumatic ways often. And yet they come in and we ask questions that are pretty irrelevant to that deeper experience, if you will. I think on the other side of embodied, you know, let's say a minority person or a refugee and immigrant in the United States might embody racism. I think that on the other side, those of us who are well-educated, middle class from the United States, often I am unaware of how I embody my own privilege and how that can actually cause oppression for other people when I make assumptions about who they are or that kind of thing. I was humbled the other night, went grocery shopping with a Somali family who was just into the United States, and they'd never been in a grocery store before. And having the opportunity to go home with them and say, this is a refrigerator, and this is what you put in a refrigerator, this is what you don't put in a refrigerator. And really takes me back to, you know, I don't ever remember not knowing that. And what does that say about me and my own place in the world? And it's, in my own research in nursing, I'm looking at how we understand our own positionality or situatedness, that we're all biased from whatever we were raised in and around. And when we become conscious of that, then we can actually move more easily into the experience of another and how that is for them.
Thank you.
So we'll figure this out. This is broadcasting. I sometimes have a difficult time talking briefly and sometimes even staying on it. But there's a word that you said when you said dilemma, describe dilemma, and I often when I talk about either the families that I work with or kind of just broadly these issues, I think of burden, and maybe it's not equivalent, but when in this short clip, and have folks seen any this documentary? Yeah, make it work for me. Thank you. Have folks seen any of the documentary? It's a great snapshot, but what you really do see, I mean, it's kind of that question I always ask people, who benefits, and especially if here in Portland, you know, our cars, the city folks have the city that works, and we're renowned for our sustainability and our green practices. But all it takes is you know, a drive up Mississippi Avenue or Alberta Street, not today, not 10 years ago, and you see those positive changes that a lot of, you know, what we think of progress and we think of what's positive, but who benefits and who burdens? And that's, you know, when I watch all of this, and that's the context that I kind of see all of this through is what are the barriers that, I mean, whether it's smoking or whether it's, you know, positive, what we would call individual choices, what kind of food you eat, organic food, do you have community gardens in your neighborhood? It's who gets to enjoy those benefits. And then, you know, for the immigrant community, and I can talk more about my work, I think, as we have a chance later, but, you know, working in housing, not only are you looking at language barriers, not only are you looking at often race and ethnicity, but there's all these other things that affect people's lives. And I think he said it great. Like, I mean, how does it affect your practice until you can start looking at what your own privilege? I mean, myself, I come from, you know, New York, although I've been here since 97, so I'm kind of considering myself a native Oregonian as well in some fashion. But being, you know, biracial with an African-American father from the South and a Jewish mother from the Bronx, it's like I've had a lot of internalized questions for myself, and I think it's made a big difference. But I think it is important that, you know, I don't know who this group are, if you guys are professionals or future medical professionals, but the reality is that's a great place to start, is really looking at where your privileges are and how you internalize the world around you. So.
Thank you. Should we, maybe there's some room for some questions maybe now, and then we could watch that other video clip and maybe then open the discussion more towards kind of a discussion together around some of the topics. What do you think? Is there any questions or just brief questions now, and then later on we can...
From your experience working with immigrants, if you have some more specific examples or like categories or like, you know, things you can bring in the discussion around the health care or the health and the challenges. Thanks.
Sure. I'm trained to be. I'm a family therapist, and in our culture, in most of the African cultures, counseling is wellness is. I mean, if you mental illness, you're either well or you're crazy on that continuum. And you just don't go to a therapist, sit across the table and talk with them as they take notes about your life. That doesn't happen. There's community. You go to family, community, the elders, churches, and whatever to deal with those kinds of issues. And there, so that's a big, problem there when people. Although I'm trained in this country, I've always felt like it's not sufficient to have the training. You just have to be part of. When I go to the families, when I go to their homes, I'm part of their family. I mean, trust goes both ways. They have, I'm trusting them to accept what I'm doing in terms of really opening up. I have to be part of their family's fabric, to really kind of get into the conversation, start a conversation about wellness. What does that mean? And really work from their own. Collective wisdom that they bring from their families, and my own included. So I address those issues accordingly, with tremendous respect for their own wisdom about where they come from and what it is that they need. I see my job as a person who's really moving, if they wish to, and when they do, to move them from point A to point B. And I'm not always successful, and that's fine. But I think the key is to have a conversation about that, and really have the deep respect for them when I go in their home. I mean, it's such a big challenge for anybody to knock at your door and say, "Here, I'm here to help you." It doesn't work that way, but that's what happens many times with the Department of Human Services, and so it really is a big challenge. But people are willing and open to have a conversation about their wellness if it is approached appropriately. Does that answer your question?
It brings like barking, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You want to say what specifically did you want
me? No, that was great. I mean, yeah. But I don't know if you has any more specific presentation of the health issues that people like. Or the child,
specific health issues,
or health, or the wellness or not wellness that the communities face. And
Basically, I think there are health issues that come up with that. They come up with physical issues, are a lot. People have gone through so many different, especially those who are coming as refugees from refugee camps. And from war-torn places. I mean, the post-traumatic stress syndromes and issues of abandonment and of just completely being lost and living in transition for the last 20 years of their lives, basically, from just not one generation, but two generations back. So it's a constant, even with all those difficulties, though. I mean, the ability for them to move from point A to point B in many ways is so amazing, the resiliency that they have. And one thing that I've noticed is that in terms of the biggest challenge is the loss of their culture, the loss of their home, the loss that cannot be replaced. And so I think when we see the issue of wellness, it's tremendous. It's a tremendous challenge. So when somebody comes in and they look fine and they're complaining about, I have my heart really is hurting me, or I can't breathe, or the anxiety. We're quick to medicate that, or pathologize everything. But it's a tremendous challenge. The health challenges are tremendous. But it is. It's understandable.
I just want to add two more things to that, what you said. So far as that's really great. There's also systemic issues that are really relevant in refugees. I don't know if you know, when they come, they are accepted as refugees, and there's a 8-month period in which they receive a lot of services, and where they, for example, have access to health care, because they get access to the Oregon Health Plan for 8 months, for the first 8 months. They have also financial support and housing support and a lot of services. The refugees that are arriving here in Portland are expected to find a job within 4 months of their arrival here. That's the standard and the expectation that the government has. So we have to find, and they have to find, jobs within 4 months of their arrival. And so to be sustainable and have a sustainable living situation within 8 months after arriving here in the United States. So there's a lot of systemic issues that are also part of the refugee and immigrant experience that co-create some of the health problems that they also have. Ms. Manjana.
Ask a little bit more. I thought it was really interesting when you were talking about your experience when you first came as an immigrant, and people kind of bombarding you with questions, and how that experience was for you. Because it's fascinating to think about how communities come together and get to know each other, even if they're maybe bringing their privilege or their lack of knowledge. And I was just wondering if you had any advice, or if you'd like to share more about that experience.
I'm thinking of many things. I come from a family. I was surprised that they were asking. I was surprised that they did not know, because we were taught about many cultures. So I was, you know, that's why I really took it humorously at some point, because it was too funny. I mean, if I told somebody that I rode, you know, my elephants to school and I left it in an elephant parking, they believed me. I'm thinking, okay, this is way too funny. So, you know, I'm just going to, but, you know, I did not take it. It was not a personal assault to me. I was really interested in why they didn't know. This is, after all, America, where everybody's supposed to be educated. I know the educational standard was, you know. So anyway, that was a big thing. And I think more than, as I lived here longer, I became a little bit more intolerant about the ignorance. But I didn't really say it out loud, so I kept it inside. And because I just, you know, because you just, it takes a lot of time to do that. I didn't have the energy to deal with, I mean, it's like, I'm responsible for my own education, not for everybody else's. But, you know, you live in a system that really opens those things up constantly. So, I mean, you just have to be diplomatic about how you deal with it, and just manage your time and say, okay, this is what I need to deal with. This one I just have to let go. But, you know, it's a constant thing. So it's, you know, it's a physically draining thing. It really becomes part of, you know, the good thing for me, I came from a culture that supported me as who I am. You know, I come from Ethiopia. Ethiopians are everywhere. So it wasn't like a challenge that I had to deal with constantly. On the other hand, I lived and learned a lot vicariously through my children. I have two children. And, you know, they have both told me, number one, they won't, you know, I send them to a school that they were the only black kids. It was close to my house. And it's not because I wasn't thinking, I didn't have the experience of being the only one in my culture growing up. So it was not an issue for me. So those issues didn't really bother me as much as the ignorance or the lack of safety in a place for a friend of mine who got killed. Those big, huge things. So, you know, I was okay. It's the problem was outside of there. For children who grow up here and see themselves as the only ones, and they don't have that, you know, strength of the community, is different. So when my kids come to, you know, when I picked them up from school and they say, well, you know, I didn't have a good day today because, and I can suspect something of that nature came up, but I never pulled that as one of the main reasons. I'd say, well, maybe they didn't like your lunchbox or yours, you know, and they say, Mom, come on, you know. So I dealt with it the best way I could because number one, I didn't really want to burden them with the whole issue of, well, it's because you're a black kid. And, you know, because it really, to me, being who I am is not a liability. So, and I didn't see it as a liability. It was other people's, if you don't like me for who I am, just because of whatever the reasons are, you know, and it's really your issue, it's not mine. So I taught that to my children, but that was not sufficient. It wasn't. And it really comes up constantly. When my son started being, when he turned 16 or when he was a young teenager, I mean, the way the community dealt with him prior to him being a teenager was much different than when he became a teenager. You know, he was automatically considered like, oh, he's like maybe a gangbanger or anything. I mean, we lived in the same house all these years, the same community shopping, and he started feeling like they follow me everywhere I go at Fred Meyer's. And I said, come on. But it's true. So, you know, you just, the way that my children lived here and the way that I raised them, I had to learn so much through them vicariously, and the way that my child stopped 3,000 times a day, and I'm exaggerating obviously, by the police because he was a black kid in the neighborhood I live, which is close by here, and there aren't many black people living in this area, so he would be stopped, and he'd be driving a car that he shouldn't be driving because it's an expensive car, and whatever. So it is such a constant reminder. So I realized as this was going on that my son really was suffering emotionally, and he was getting depressed, and so, you know, this really affected him, his wellness, his mental health. But, you know, he has some tools that I have, you know, that he's learned himself. He's a great kid, and has, you know, he really has, I've given him somehow some voice to say to his community, to the police, and say, you know what, I'm tired of you stopping me. Or, you know, so it's a constant thing. You know, it's a very unhealthy environment for black kids, unfortunately. You know, but, you know, you just can't think about it constantly because it really could be a lot more detrimental when you think about it too. So.
Well, and those are, I think, stories that we've heard and that we hear and experience. And now we finally can start looking at data that actually shows the long-term health implications of a lifetime of discrimination, of a lifetime of racism, of a lifetime of oppression, of a lifetime of not being represented by leadership, by a lifetime of having other people make policy decisions for you. And now we're starting to actually see data that shows, and people are actually thinking about this from an evaluation standpoint, and it's really powerful. And I know this, you know, spoiled the video because I know there's a lot of that's in this video. But it really, I mean, that story is the same story that's being told with every, you know, young black mother that I go visit at home. And, you know, those questions, their child's 4 or 5 years old, and they're already stressing about how am I going to teach this child to grow up in this environment? How am I going to give them the tools that they need to be able to ask the cop, you know, why are you stopping me? in a way? Or how do you even learn to deal with that situation, because it's going to happen? And what's the age when you tell them? And you know, I'm not a parent, but I can only imagine what that feeling must be like and what that child's development and how it's affected by that reality. So
I'd like to address health equity in terms of how we're teaching about this in nursing and medicine. I think until very recently, we have not addressed this. Right now, we're calling it health equity, and what we won't say, it's institutionalized racism. And it's a difficult topic to take up because I'm white. I might not believe it really. You know, I don't have the lived experience. When are we going to hear the stories of individuals who have this, you know, repeated over and over and over? And then how will it change the way that we are with them in that way? In 2002, the Institute of Medicine came out with a pivotal document called Unequal Treatment. That is a disparaging piece of documentation about how ethnic minorities in the United States have a much higher burden of disease, incidence and prevalence of disease, and so on. And we've known that. I mean, that's been a rumor that we've always known. However, what they also came up with is how we as health providers provide different care, different levels of care, different social care to different groups. Literally, certain groups will be prescribed differently than others. And it's a powerful commentary on healthcare in the United States today. And I think we're afraid. I mean, it's pretty traumatic to really talk in school about racism and what is that experience. How do we manage a classroom if it gets out of control? And then when do we teach the Krebs cycle if they're so upset about racism? And it's a struggle. It's also a struggle because at the same time we're trying to be more efficient and we need to work with you in 12 minutes or less. And you're coming up with all this complex stuff that is just overwhelming. What do we do with it? And the truth is it's more than healthcare's responsibility. It's society's responsibility. It's our job as citizens to work on issues around social justice. Because if you believe that everybody has equal right to healthcare, human rights are all interconnected. Somebody's right to health care interconnects with their right to education. If they're not healthy, their kids are not healthy. If you're getting beat up at school every other day, you are not going to have the capacity as an individual or as a community to be as highly educated, therefore to do all of the things that education and the luxury of education brings. So it's all interconnected.
I wanted to say one thing in terms of the work that I do. I think something that has worked for me is because of the problem that we face as people of color, immigrants, whatever. One thing that has worked for me is I understanding that the fact that who I am is not a liability. It's a big, huge thing because that really clears the way for understanding other people's behavior and your own. So in the work that I do with communities that I'm serving, I really get to that point. Who are you? You know, what's your purpose in this world? I mean, what everything that has happened to you, yourself is separate from your experiences. You know, that does not define you. And it doesn't define who you are. So understanding that really empowers you and gives you the responsibility to say, this is myself, and really start defining that on a regular, it's called affirmation, whatever it is, but really understanding that, you know, you are, and that's the other fallacy of a lot of the social services that we provide, you know, like if you have had alcohol difficulties, you are part of an organization and you just take on that, you know, the victim role that forever. I mean, you just hold on to that almost like a religion. If you're a rape victim, you are a victim. You know, no, it's not. I mean, that thing happened to yourself. that's separate from who you are. It's an experience that never defines you. So that's one thing that I've always tried to focus on in terms of working, because it really, I mean, the ability that the human psyche to heal itself and to understand that we can move, I mean, as just, I mean, it's tremendous. So it's so critical that I always think about that, go to that point where it's, I am not defined by my experiences.
That's profound. I really want to, yeah, how is that for me? Is that, how often can I really live by that, and how often not? I'm noticing I've kept kind of track of the different issues and topics that were brought up, the racism, the ignorance, and the tolerance, and how tolerant I experienced you towards racism and somehow, and the fear of addressing these issues, and yeah, the cultural beliefs and the privilege of, and the lack of awareness and knowledge in the people who are more privileged. These are all some of the issues that I noted here. Now, I'm in a kind of, as a facilitator, in a little dilemma here. I'm just going to mention that, how shall we go on? I also had a video prepared to introduce some of the world work concept, but I'm not 100% sure if that's how we want to go as a group. Shall we go deeper in some of the issues that have already been brought up, or would you want to watch that? How shall we do that? I have both sides. I just want to look some of the feedback.
I have one question.
Okay, or more questions.
I want to appreciate all of you for your what you're bringing personally. It's just wonderful. Thank you. And your work, yes. And you've mentioned several times wellness. It's like a concept of wellness, and I find myself thinking I should know what that means. But I'm not sure I do. You actually said something like that you can bring wellness to people, and I thought, oh my God, this is like a commodity that you actually can help give people, and it just my mind got excited. So I'd love to hear more about your concept of wellness.
It starts from a very simple point. It's not complicated. I think I see life as a very simple. We're talking about differences of cultures, and you know, the fact that I'm from Ethiopia is quite incidental. I didn't say, "Oh, can I be from there?" Just happened. So, I tend to. It's maybe sometimes oversimplified, but I tend to simplify things for what it is. I mean, it is what it is. And I try to peel things to the core and try to understand, okay, why am I feeling the way I'm feeling? And takes the responsibility, and leave the responsibility that I can't affect out. And try to, stay in the moment. What's happening at this moment? You know, somebody chasing me with a hatchet to pay my bills. Somebody out there trying to hurt my family. You know, think about all what that is well at this moment. And that's the only time you can be creative. And we only have the moment to do that, to live that, because we don't have, I mean, the next moment, we never know what happens. The past is gone. You know, it's a reservoir of experiences and all that to think about. But I think staying in the moment as much as possible, it's a really hard thing to do. Very, very hard. I mean, we have so much going on. But if you really think about that, that's where wellness is. That's where you can find, you know, we spend so much time worrying about things that ought to do, had, should have been, and all that. You know, I don't know anything. I don't know much, but I just know that nobody's out there trying to get me this moment. I can just do as much as I can at this moment, and I bring that with me wherever I go, and I look for that, you know, in the places that I go, and I usually find it. So I stay, you know, I could be really sick many times, but, you know, I think it really is, I don't know what it is, but it's whatever that is in the moment, that it is possessed in many other, in a lot of people collectively. I mean, if it's just being aware and tapping, you know, at that resource that we all have, reservoir that we all have, and I don't own it, just...
Like in the beginning, you talk about education and the American being very educated or something. But it's amazing the teaching that you're bringing in and educating us, and how you speak, like with your bringing out your experience. So there must be something of this, of the experience that the immigrants also bring, and the richness that, you know, that there's a big teaching. But you, person, I mean everybody who spoke, and yeah, I just wanted to say that, like about. I felt taught, yeah.
I'd like to invite the nurse, somebody out of the nurse, to really address wellness, and we'll see if you learned your lessons in class.
It wasn't what I was going to talk about. I'm going to break the rules, and I'm not going to talk about wellness, but just as someone who's going into the health profession and the kind of power that that comes with as people kind of listen to your what you have to say as truth, or as that you're more educated about wellness or health. I'm struggling this term to figure out. We're doing commute work with African immigrant and refugee communities on coming from that place and trying to not feel like I'm pushing an agenda, or that how do you go into a community and say, like, what do you need help with? And without seeming like, well, first of all, you're saying you need, I'm saying I think you need help, and how, and there are problems, and but finding that balance, and as a health professional, like just trying to be really intentional and aware of my own assumptions, but really struggling with meeting people and trying to, you know, connect those two things without being oppressive or pushing my agenda or making assumptions, I guess.
Struggle in those communities with wanting to be mindful and not, you know, not offend and all of that, and yet they need to know how we live in America. One of the issues that we're finding with incoming Africans is there, you know, different, well, France, anywhere you go to, there's a different conception of what hygiene is, period. Sometimes it has to do with just habits within the culture. Sometimes it has to do with accessibility to water. So that often some of the individuals and families that we work with smell different than a typical Western-raised individual, which sometimes will cost them their jobs. So we can't be so cautious that we, you know, we kind of march around, that we have to say, hey, you need to wear deodorant, and you need to bathe this often, and to really, you know, step forward in that. We're also pretty assertive around children. People who have been raised in a community environment where all adults are responsible for all children. I mean, I would wake up in West Africa, there'd be 14 kids sleeping on my porch, and I'd think, where did they come from? Where are their parents? But nobody's worried about it but me. Well, when that practice happens here, 2 and 3-year-olds are running around on busy streets. Actually, a child was killed about 2 years ago. Yeah. And we don't want to do that. So we're being really assertive. You know, if you let your kids run around, the United States takes your children away and puts them in a different home. So you can't do that here. So I often struggle between being pretty assertive and direct and then really not wanting to offend. And it's a hard balance. I don't always know.
You know, one of the positions when I first, you know, I've been with the county about 5 years now, and one of the first, you know, we do a lot of grant-funded projects, and there was a Somali child, I think it was a Somali child in New Hampshire who had died of lead poisoning. So somehow, you know, the EPA got all this grant money to say, all right, well, must be this problem within the Somali community and around lead poisoning. And so we went, and maybe, you know, this is one of those things that, again, struggling with identity and looking at what that means, you know, being the, like the brown outreach worker was like, well, you know, you can go talk to the Somali workers, you know, the Somali folks, because, you know, you're brown, so that should work. So, you know, which is obviously not the way you would do it. But I do want to try to answer your question, because one of the things I think that answer was great, and the wellness piece, to come back without having to define it, but do the wellness piece. But I'm a really firm advocate and training and hiring people of that community for that community to speak to that community where they're comfortable in their own space, in their own language, et cetera. So, I mean, you might find yourself like me, hired into some job where you're like, well, go talk to the Somali folks. Like, one, I don't know where they're living. I don't know. At that point, I knew nothing about any of these people.
Right. That's where I'm kind of at, is just kind of figuring out, as somebody not in their community, how to interact and be a part of it.
It took me time, but what I found to be most helpful is most communities have leaders, they have elders. They have, I mean, a lot of times community health nurses are great, you know, someone that's already been working there. There's a lot of avenues into communities if you talk to the right people. I guess that's, you know, from a practical practice standpoint.
I also just want to mention, I mean, these topics, these are really important topics, and are they related? How are they interrelated? The refugee experience and the children that are walking on the street, or the lead poisoning, is that happening in just the refugee communities? Also, just has that to do with poverty or class? What is it? What are these factors that, you know, and we can easily project and have some prejudices around certain specific characteristic or behaviors in a certain community, which may not really have nothing to do with the community itself, or just poverty or racism. I mean, I just want to also just question ourselves. What is it?
I wanted to share one thing with you that worked with me. I'm from Africa, and when Pierre asked me to work with him to do some engagement work with the African community in terms of mental health, you know, I'm from Ethiopia. The people that I've been hired to work with, most of them were from Somalia. There's cultural differences and, you know, political contentions and all that. So, you know, that's not my stuff, but I acknowledged it for what it is. But quickly what I tried to find out is who are the people that are in their circle of influence. And one of them, I mean, since they're newcomers, a lot of them have been assigned to American volunteers who have been working with the family. And they were all Caucasians. And so they were my entree into their community. It just happened. They've had time with the family. You know, I didn't matter at that point who that person was, it just happened to be the person that was the closest to the family. It just happened to be the volunteers, American volunteers. They had established a relationship with the family. So I got to know the volunteers, and they introduced me to the family as their friend. So the trust was already built. So, you know, it was a plus that I was from Africa, but it was not right off the bat. So That also, you know, is a way of just finding, you know, who are they hanging out with? Who do they trust in their community? And for the most part, a lot of them who come into the culture are given certain instructions about do not share some information with anybody, because of the immigration status. They don't. So it's really hard to find, you know, to get that. You know, and then, you know, for the first 8 months, they are bombarded with a lot of people, you know, social services, you know, and then you want to, it's like, what do you want? So I think if you know, you know, first of all, I want you to relax. You know, just relax because, you know, just, and know, you know, with yourself, just relax and say, okay, you know, where am I going to go with this information? And people just read that. And then just, you know, technically just find ways of, you know, find people that are, work around them and just, that would be, just relax though, really relax. Because I think we always try not to offend people. You know, nobody is culturally proficient about anybody's or, you know, all the time. You know, so it's just relax.
There can be issues also with, I mean, you should allowing people to tell you. People will tell you what they want. I mean, that's something as well. I mean, if you give the time and establish that trust and relationship, people will tell you. I mean, it's hard for me as a, you know, coming in with the governor, you know, in the government car or pulling up. There's historical distrust both with immigrant and refugee populations, but also with many of the people of color populations. Here, you know, you pull up with a Multnomah County logo and they think you're, you know, delivering a sermon or a summons or something like that, you know, or a ticket or whatever. So, but I think people really do have a desire. One, they know what they don't know a lot of times. Two, they trust that once that relationship's built, that you're there to help, and that's a positive thing.
I don't mean to be Pollyanna about this. That's a cultural, if you know about Pollyanna, that's one way to think about it. But sometimes there is so much connection among people and that the assumption is there's going to be a big difference because Asafash was raised in Ethiopia and I'm raised here. We're so much alike and we're such good friends. And she and I might be much closer than somebody who lives next door to me, that sometimes the diversity within any given group is more than the diversity between groups, and to just be mindful about that. And humans all have really pretty similar needs. When I open my heart and sit down, that is sensed by people around you. And sometimes it's not my right to be on the inside of a community, period. And that's hard as a direct provider. I'm a nurse practitioner. I'm used to getting my hands right on. But when I'm working with these incoming communities, I might be one or two or three layers out. And what is my role as advocate and ally? Who do I need to work with? Who's going to be the conduit into the community? And if I'm not the right person, then I need to put my ego, privilege and power aside and do what I can do on the outside for the wellness of the community and how they define their own wellness.
Looking around, any other questions? Or would it be okay to watch that other thing? Would that be good? Okay.
Your last statement is incredibly important. Is driving the ego and letting, releasing power. I mean, when we talk about institutional racism and how do you dismantle that, part of it is that ego, the letting go of that power. And, so I just wanted to.
I'm also going to stand on a soapbox about healthcare. To have that kind of humility around a community is not how we're trained. How we're trained as professionals is to be the experts. And I'll let you know what you need to know and let me teach you in this kind of thing. And it simply does not work. And so what we need, the skills that we most need out in the community are antithetical to how we're trained so far. And so it's a struggle. And we're really trying to really shift profoundly how we teach and what we teach. So that will change politically.
One more comment on that, because I want to add that it's also who are we teaching, not who are we teaching within the community. Who are we teaching at OHSU? who are we teaching at Oregon College, and I wish I could be better with data than, you know, repeating numbers, but they just came out with a report, and it's like less than 1% of our graduates in any kind of science field, biology, chemistry, you know, all the natural sciences, physical sciences, we're graduating less than 1% of people of color out of Oregon institutions. And that cannot all be blamed on the demographics of the state. I know this is a white state, but our graduation should mirror our population.
Okay, Betsy, we're going to... We often make it about communities. Well, you know, if you had anybody who could really, you know, go through our rigorous program, then you'd be here, but you can't really do it. Rather than really look inside about where that racism shows up on admissions, differently knowing students, do they survive our programs? How do we need to shift in order to honor the expertise of different ways of knowing? There are some... I'm going to say this in public. There are times at OHSU, we're very linear, that I feel like I could cut my head off and send it to a faculty meeting. You know, that we're so cognitive about how we work in the world, research and, you know, all those kinds of things. And yet the people we're working with are much more embodied in their understanding. We have to change if we're going to be able to meet the growing demands of diversity. We have diversity now that was unimaginable 20 years ago, an interconnection in the world. So we are compelled to change.
Let me
I'll take you a while to get that going. And I'm just going to show my lack of understanding in where the healthcare community is going with this, but someone who is outside of it, but having worked with a fair amount of immigrants in the workforce, I never saw the women. I'd see the men would come to work, the younger women would come to work, but the women our age I never saw, and I oftentimes worried about them. So how do you, you know, we're talking about the inequality, and I never saw how a vast majority of the immigrant community lived. So how do you go about determining, you know, who's healthy, who's not? You just pop in and check them out, or what's your numbers showing? How are you doing? I mean, it sounds like you're doing that, but there's a vast amount of that community that most of the people on the outside never do see.
Where are they? I think in terms of data, I mean, she would probably have that in terms of how you get the data. The fact that's a good statement to make, because they're quite invisible, aren't they? And that has a lot to do with their place at home and in the community. There's no place, you know, it's like not, you know, I remember not being available for every school game at school because I have to work. So, you know, so I'm not, you know, I think that's, I don't have the answer, but I acknowledge that they are invisible.
But isolation must be incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, you know, hence many, many issues that comes along with that in terms of health and mental illness. But she has the data.
I'm not going to a data place. This is what I would say. Notice where you're looking. They're invisible to you because you don't know where to look and you don't know what you're looking for. I can tell you there are strong communities of women our age out there, and they're connected to each other, but not in places where we know how to go. Like, where do you hang out? What do you notice? Notice what you're noticing, because whatever takes our attention also determines what we miss. And there are huge communities. Ladies, they just found this invisible community the other day that, you know, and they're not invisible. You just have to link in differently. They're differently visible, I would say.
And it's an adjustment as well. I mean, these are communities that are forming. I mean, so people are, there is a social isolation piece, but there's also a building social capital. I think of like the work that Lul does, you know, with the sewing groups and things like that that are bringing women together. But I think, you know, what in a lot of ways was lost from Inner Northeast Portland will be established somewhere else. You know, the folks that were displaced, they will coalesce again and have those communities and have those spaces. And so, you know, I think one, they are there, and I think two, it also takes time to really rebuild those networks, find, you know, who, and redefine who your community is.
And that I won't argue at all, because if you go to IRCO, you see the wonderful sewing groups, it's there and it's powerful. But as far as the isolation from the rest of mainstream society in Oregon and how this impacts their health and the inequality, how can I, as a person on the street, or I, as an employer, make sure that, you know, I'm helping out? Because I am not invited to their sewing circles. I am not invited to where this invisible group is for me. That's all.
Yeah, I think that's great that you want that. There are connections that you can make to be part of that, and that really is the greatest thing in any community for newcomers. I remember one thing that I didn't like is I didn't want people to come see me like they're going to the zoo to see, hey, we have an African in my home or something like that. It was just like, it was a bit odd, you know, and I remember those situations where people say, you know, with good intentions, many times, not all the time, you know, you take it as it comes, but I think, you know, that, but the thing is, if your intention is really to get to know, you know, there is a connection that you can make, and it is really a wonderful way of connecting, and they would appreciate, I mean, I would appreciate that. It's a wonderful thing to make a connection with somebody from a different place, who's really trying to be part of a community, and I think that's the greatest way to build that, and I really appreciate that question.
I would also add there's a lot of points. I mean, if we're looking at root causes, you know, discrimination, oppression, lack of access, lack of power, let's look at who you're voting. I mean, one of the day-to-day kind of thing, you know, who represents you, who you vote for, you know, what, you know, who's doing Jobs with Justice, for example, comes to mind, or Community Alliance of Tenants or something. There's all these different Josiah Coe Clinic. I mean, there's a variety of different access points of people that are doing work to address the root causes, people that are looking at community design in terms of eliminating social isolation and trying to create more community spaces. And, you know, a lot of times, of course, that doesn't necessarily work for everyone. It's like, who's the city livable for? It's not always, those communities aren't always designed where the people need them the most or the people that are most vulnerable. But there are people and places trying to really look at those root causes. I don't know if that's a great answer, but I mean, I think it's a common question. People say, well, what can we do on a day-to-day basis? Or if I know this exists, I know some things, you know, I can do in my own life to try to get better clarity or wellness, but what can I do to help these seemingly, you know, just huge, huge, huge problems?
Thanks, everybody. This is just an observation, but, you know, maybe this is kind of a pat yourself on the back moment just for a second. I mean, whether you want to get into plugging right into organizations that are trying to change root causes or trying to make your vote count. I mean, you're all here right now. I'm not a medical student or healthcare student by any means, not at all, but I see a professor here that asked her students to attend here. I see a government employee here and a social service worker that just doing the very thing that you're doing right now is the point, I think. Whether that turns into voting in an elected official that's going to kick money down to IRCO, or, I mean, who knows? But it's what you're doing right now that matters. So, anyway, good job. And, you know, of course, don't get too happy about patting yourself on the back, but it's one of those kind
why
of moments,
not?
I think. Yes. So congratulations.
Well, why not? Thank you. Why not? Thank you.
That was touching. Yeah, you get a pet. We need all to be petted, and we need this. I'm trying. Is that okay? Let me say you also why. What's the vision behind for me? What's why I'm so passionate? I want to show that it's also going to be maybe a transition to then the larger open forum that we are planning to have in January. So it's introducing some concept of facilitation, and that might be helpful for us to work as a community. And helpful to some tools and some skills that I'm passionate about, that I think are really good for working in open forums and things like that. So that that's why I wanted to introduce them to you. Is that good?
Do you mind if I do a plug before?
Yes, do a plug.
A plug. Just we've been, and some of you may have participated with Multnomah County Health Department. Actually, Multnomah County, but led in the health department. We did what's called a health equity initiative. We're still involved in the process. We've been using this film as a way to start dialogues around what health equity is and policy and solutions to try to advance to look at some of these root causes. So I'd encourage you to go to www.mchealth.org/health equity. That's a little plug. I'll plug more stuff later.
That's good. That's great.
Thanks.
Can I add a little, an extra little? You all have been working with my school, NCNM. And we have I'll put in a plug for the next event for that, which is coming up in November, right? November 19th at 6 p.m. You'll be sure.
19th at 6 p.m. at Northwest College of Naturopathic Medicine?
Or National College of
Naturopathic. National College,
yeah.
Sorry.
Begins at the point where I would say communication breaks down. And it begins at the place where its emotions are complicating a cooperation process or a resolution process. One of the real strengths of the process work model is that we are trained to work with the very difficult, volatile, and frightening emotions that surround conflict, whether that's the trauma in the aftermath of violence or conflict, whether that's revenge and anger, whether that's hatred, or just pain, rage, sadness, that we understand, and perhaps coming from a psychological background, we understand that putting those aside isn't always possible. If it's possible, great. When it's not, that's where the process work model comes in, and we allow people to come to a resolution by coming through their emotions and expressing them and bringing in these more difficult aspects of the conflict process.
So process work and what we call world work, which is the application of process work to conflict resolution, is applied in many different situations, in different neighborhoods in conflict, in mediation, and forums of people gathering to work on issues of developing as a multicultural society, diversity issues, and post-war conflict situations, conflict prevention, taking place in different neighborhoods, in conflict zones, and also in training environments where people are gathered to learn about facilitation skills. I'm remembering when we were in Slovakia at World Work, and there were two women from Croatia there.
When I came to a World Work seminar in Slovakia, I had the strangest feeling. And it was very overwhelming for me, and it stayed with me for a long time that I finally came home. It was a big discovery for me. At that time, my country was in a very, very bloody war, and I was engaged in work with refugees.
And so we ended up creating a long-term project together in Croatia, doing post-war reconciliation and community building work. This whole project was supported by the United Nations High Commission for Refugees and also the Office for Security and Cooperation in Europe, several embassies, the Threshold Foundation, the Open Society Institute, and Office for Transition Initiatives, and I may forget some others, but it was very well supported with the idea that it was essential for the people who were in the field trying to grapple with these very difficult issues of reconciliation, returning to their homes, beginning to live together, how to do this, that these people could gather and meet among themselves and work on the very conflicts that they were working with in the field, among themselves, as Serbs, Croats, Muslims, all with their own war experiences.
That afternoon, one of the women from Sarajevo said, she says, I need to speak. And she says, she looked around at everyone and she said, you're looking at us like museum pieces. Mm-hmm. Speaking to the rest of the group, you look but don't touch. And what she was describing was Sarajevo had been, everybody had been very much affected by the war, but Sarajevo had been recently so hard hit and it was very present. And so she says this, and I don't know if you wanted to kind of show that a little bit. She walked across the room, and she sat in front of her like this, I think. She's on her knees. And then she just said, it's true. It was very simple, but very profound. She says, it's true. I keep you at a distance. And then she went on to say, I remember watching on television Sarajevo, and you were only 150 kilometers away from me, but the war at that time had stopped where I was. And I remember watching television, and I would look at that and I couldn't feel it. It was just on television and I couldn't feel it. And there was a kind of pause, and then she says, and I remember being glad that it was there and not here. And when she said this, eye to eye, looking at our friend from Sarajevo, she began to cry, and then the woman from Sarajevo began to cry. And it was so simple but so profound, and the whole group, and in process work groups, for anyone who's been in process work circles, you see a lot of emotion all the time. But I've never seen something like this. Every single person in the group of about 70 people began to weep, like tears streaming down their faces. And you could just look around one by one, and Elaine and I were crying, and then the translator started trembling and crying and saying, I shouldn't, because everything's translated into Croatian and English. And we said, look, it's okay. And she literally fell to the ground and heaped and just began to weep. And others would pass around the translating job. And I noticed we still got moved telling the story. It became kind of myth. That, you know, through this interaction, we can really become closer, we can understand different parts of history or different histories there. And we ended up the seminar with such excitement of, and I remember a colleague who was there and he faced this, putting a puzzle together. One of the important things to all of us, I think, something that I went through a lot of soul searching around, was how do you work in a situation with that much trauma? And some of you know that methods and process work, that if you touch a hot spot, a place where there's that spot that kind of sizzles and we want to back off from it, and we know in process work that if you go there carefully and facilitate, that can be a doorway to a transformation. Go on and do that some more. And then suddenly, Tanya, maybe you can just stop it! Yeah, something like that. Someone just came in and went through.
I didn't really see that it's really, especially in a situation like Croatia at that moment, that on a collective level, that things can be really worked on. So that has changed, obviously. And that moment when I got to that first warm, I think, was one of the major influences on me that this change has happened. My first meeting with the hotspot, when you and Lane said this is a hotspot, was like, you know, why to stay here? Because this is like, it's so tough. Mm-hmm. You know, it's tough, and it's, it just brings me more just physical reactions to that. And I've noticed that around. But then, you know, when it was like slowly going over there, and surely it wasn't easy. But then, even when the momentary resolution didn't happen, but it was at least somehow open up, it was afterwards better.
What's amazing about process work is the elegance of the theory. The model's very simple, and it can be applied to such a wide range of situations and applied in very diverse ways, and yet that model stays the same. So it has, I think it has great efficacy because of that. We found that a lot of resolution happens when people are really able to say the things and feel the things that they're carrying with them. And kind of the rational conflict resolution procedure of agreeing, you know, it works with certain things, but actually when there's like histories of conflict or trauma, or when there's been, you know, deep inequities and oppression, it's very hard to just get to a place of sort of talking through talking points, you know? And so that's, I think, that's the place I see the process work conflict resolution model.
So when we frame the roles or the polarization of a conflict and represent these as roles, we sometimes will encourage people, or people spontaneously want to do that as a role play. You can kind of step into that role and play it, because you know these inside yourself, and you've seen others in that role. And so it can begin as a sort of role play, but then it shifts, and people begin to speak very personally inside of those roles. They may be able to go back and forth, find themselves in the other role. This is a kind of inner work where you find how do the parts of the conflict outside of oneself occur inside. Or you may speak very personally in a role, telling your personal and family story. And people in this way discovering how they're a part, how they're responsible, how they're engaged, and interacting with the conflict together and finding a way forward together.
I'm going to take one role, which says something like, I have a very great religion, and my religion says, I have the way. And for you all, out of the way. Out of the way. This is war. My way is the way. Your way okay. That's the beginning.
I have very strong reaction what you said.
Nobody, we don't strong reactions we're not interested in. we only talk to our own. Anybody? Oh,
we think you're ridiculous. Yeah.
This is somebody on my team, so I can talk to them. Somebody help me out with this role eventually, because only a certain amount of sweat is good for the shirt.
Debate is clear.
It's not clear.
The book says it, and we follow it, and it's clear.
Come on.
It's really enough here. Nobody's saying stop. There's you, the moss, there's you, there's all of you. Stay with it.
Stay here.
Stay and hold.
I'm not interested.
But
no,
it's happening.
I like you, but
that's
what is happening.
Don't kill everybody.
That's what's happening.
So just because it's happening, it's good.
I feel relieved.
you. Come back. That's good. Bye. So what's next? Is there any questions about that, about the movie, or ongoing questions for the presenters? Checking.
Or maybe two, yeah. Just reactions or feelings of what you witnessed or what it might have brought up watching that.
The idea for me to bring that I'm also was to show some possibilities. This is a conflict facilitation method that I think is relevant in this, in all different issues, and could be relevant to the issues of health equity and health inequities and ways how we deal as a community. And if I relate it back to the discussion we had before, some of the topics are actually very deeply emotional topics, like what you presented, Asafaj, and also the issues of privilege and racism. And how do we deal, as a community, how do we deal with these issues? Talking about it, there's a lot of different levels of interventions and things that we need to do as a community on education, like we do here, change of policies that are needed to change the rules and the inequalities and things. This is really important and need to be done. But then there's an emotional level of issues that still is underlying underneath, that how can we process them together, about what does it mean to be an immigrant and having to, and all these emotions that we keep inside and that we internalize, and how do we process them as a community together? How can we do that? Can we learn to do that and go deeper into these feelings? Thanks, Ed.
I think it would have been so wonderful to have this meeting, this discussion. Your talks should have been on TV this evening so that the whole city can see this and hear this. That surely can't hurt. And then maybe we could have open forums in these communities that we're talking about, the immigrant communities, where these things can come out. Years ago we had, I forgot which channel that was here in Portland.
It was a cable channel. It's one of the cable channels.
That
public.
We did an open forum, and the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and trans, and the issues associated with that, that's still shown on TV every now and then. Mm-hmm. Things like that might make life a little bit easier. It certainly didn't hurt. So that's one thought I have.
I was just going to say, one, that there's incredible value to stories, I think, in general. And so anytime you can provide an opportunity for people both to tell their stories and to listen, I think what you're describing is probably one of those. And I know, you know, Casey Jama is at Center for Intercultural Organizing is providing some of that opportunity. Mm-hmm. And the other point, you know, I was going to, I guess, in line with stories, you know, I worked with a lot of housing, public housing in particular, and, you know, there was a housing project out near PCC Cascade that had a large influx of Somali residents and a historical African-American community that lived there. And it wasn't my, I mean, I'm not a mediator or conflict resolution person, but that was one of those situations that probably would have benefited from some of the expertise and the people in those rooms, because there was this deep-rooted kind of trauma and different kinds of trauma on both sides. So you had a refugee community that has gone through all the kind of situations that you've already spoken about, just in terms of, you know, assimilation and not even to the point of assimilation, just being part of the United States. And then there's this deep-rooted trauma that African-American community had experienced. And it came down to things like after-school tutoring. You know, now you're having all these language servers. They had a resident services coordinator, spoke their language. And it's like, it was seen as like a slight to a community that's always been there. And so these, I mean, we see it every day. And that's just one example within, VK, thanks for joining. Just one example, just within a small community that we see these kind of tensions arise. So.
Let me say something that came up for me talking about this. When I'm up here, I'm often talking from, I mean, I can imagine myself in a white coat and I'm the professor and this kind of thing, you know. What is at a deeper, more of a heartfelt level is I feel overwhelmed by these kind of disparities. Like a burden of responsibility. I am a nurse practitioner. I can't do anything about it. How can I, as an individual, combat these very complex things? Also, I notice that when I'm listening to stories, I want enough of a story so I feel compassion. But to go to the heart of people who have been tortured and have seen their children die is it feels big for me, and I want to avoid that kind of pain so that my life can stay tidy and I'm doing a good job and I get to pat myself on the back. But it terrorizes me to really go to that place, and I feel powerless.
Oh, I think that's such a wonderful thing that you come out and say that. I just want to thank you for that. That is one of the great problems around conflict work, I think. That people who we need there are so shy and afraid of what might happen. I think it's very, very right what you said. But the sometimes amazing things can happen too. I still remember the scene in Oakland years ago, just before the Rodney King trial. The racism cops were terrible too. You know, you may know that the cops were terrible towards this African-American man. And there was a trial about those cops. The next day it was Oakland. And a couple of days later, many African-American population communities in different parts of the country blew up. It was a riot. But San Francisco, it didn't happen. And San Francisco Chronicle gave us credit for the fact that it didn't happen, though I think that wasn't the case. It was just one spot where we worked things out to a resolution. And the resolving person was just one man, one single man in a group of hundreds of people. It was a terrible moment when the people were just saying, well, you people of color, this and the other, saying, you white folks, that. And suddenly one man came out and he just said, oh, it's just so painful. It's just what you were saying, the unspoken truth. It's just so painful. And it moved. He moaned and it moved many people, moved everyone finally. And bit by bit, first one person, then another person, everybody formed around him like one solid human body. We all, hundreds of people who didn't like each other at all, suddenly found a moment of coming together. It's everybody's pain. He said, it's everybody's pain. You guys are in pain. We've been in pain forever and ever. And there was no riot in San Francisco after that. I'm not so sure that's good or bad. I just want to say, in the moment when you're hopeless, just talking about that can have an immense an immense effect on others. It's not everything. But I just wanted to thank you for saying that.
You know, that is so, I think that's what we're talking about in terms of the ability to heal. And I think, you know, when we talk about what these people went through or those people went through, it really is everybody going through the same thing. Collectively, it affects all of us, as, you know, consciously. We may not deal with it. You know, and I mean, just look around and you're, take a quick thought for yourselves and think, you know, what traumas have there been in your life? Everybody has something. You know, my pain is not bigger than yours. It's my pain, and that's yours is yours. But I think we're so interconnected at such a higher level that we're not even aware of it. So it's easier sometimes to shut down because it's just, you know, we have to move on and survive. But the thing is, you know, what happened over here would affect this person over here eventually. And for people who are starting to be conscious of it, you feel it a lot faster than before. And I think that's the key. You know, talking about it gets you there a little bit faster than if we didn't. So that is...
I think what I was struck by what everybody's saying and by watching the movie was about just how much something I've sort of noticed it before, but now it's just sort of coming together about how often the way that we sort of approach these issues is by having people who are usually the oppressed population get up and tell us stories about their experience of oppression, and how much that creates a situation where you know they're talking about a trauma, while you know someone like me who's not up there talking about trauma in my life gets to sort of interact with it in sort of an intellectual way of like, oh, look what we can do to change, you know, like, and you're, you know, and then, you know, these folks are the ones up here sharing their traumas, you know, and so I think about how in that movie, and then also with Isabel talking about, you know, her experience and you know, kind of bringing another, how is it, like that really this whole inequality traumatizes all of us, and it sort of continues a relationship of power to have it, you know, be only a certain group of people who have to share their traumas. And I think that it also sort of opens a door, it seems like, to a pity sort of situation of like, oh, those poor people, you know, like, you know, and it's very important. And so I feel like that what the movie brought up and what everybody seems to be talking about is that is about an opening of all of those doors, so that everyone in the room is sharing their real experience of what it is, and that we're all relating to what's going on in our community in a real way. Instead of just watching other people.
There's a book by, I hope I'll pronounce her name right, it's Dr. Joy DeGray-Leary, who I think is at PSU. It's called Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome. And it's, I mean, as we're looking at trauma, I mean, it's about African Americans in the United States that really have, I mean, it's very similar to what we've seen from Holocaust families. I mean, as a guy with a mother that's Jewish, I know the story of my family and where they came from, how they got here, what their experiences were. That is passed on as a legacy that, as a Jew, we will never forget. Slavery hasn't been passed around like that. I mean, we know the existence and we've heard of it, but she really dives into this book about what that legacy of trauma and that passed down trauma means for health, you know, physical health, for mental health. So I would just encourage you guys either read it or at least go listen or speak about it. Because, I mean, as we're having a conversation about trauma, it's not just, you know, those from war-torn countries or that lost a friend or a relative, you know, always too early. It's almost institutional trauma. So I would just, it's just a plug for her.
Maybe we should put it on, you could later put it in the name of the book on the things for everybody to have. Say again.
Post-traumatic slave syndrome. And Dr. Joy DeGray-Leary, D DEGRUYLEARY.
Just, there was a date that was mentioned in Seaman, and also the website that you mentioned. To write those down, too, for people would be great.
There was a wonderful documentary on PBS, and it was a project, I don't remember the name of the head of Black Studies at Harvard, but or whatever the correct term is. He did a project with genealogists about tracing certain people's ancestry through whatever records are available. Slave ship records, plantation records, and it was really fascinating. It was such a moving project, because what it meant to people to know where they came from, that they had a history that they could name, was remarkable. It would be great if everybody could have the resources to do that.
I mean, we're getting to the end, and we are kind of collecting different resources and informations and stuff that we need somehow to share with each other. And maybe we can do that by putting some of the information on the board. I also want to invite anybody who is interested in helping Katya and me and others to prepare that larger open forum, to connect with me or Katya, so that we can together reach out into the community and do that open forum, which is planned to be on January 26th. And so helping us create that and reaching out into the community to bring it out more and have a larger discussion around these really important issues that around health and the social determinants and the emotional impact of what it means to go through all these experiences of racism and health inequities and these issues. That would be really wonderful if you could let us know. I'm going to put my email address on top so you can connect with me, and I will collect and then reach out to you and maybe see how we can create that next event.
Thanks, Pia. Just to add on, I'll leave a sheet here where you can put your name and mailing, your email address, so we can get in touch with you if you like. And then I just wanted to point out that we have a few brochures here about process work training opportunities. And in my feeling, I kind of feel like process work is addressing health in general, in all of its different approaches to training from this multi-level perspective. So if you're interested, there's various things going on here. One around children, parenting, and schools. And then also our Summer Institute that's coming up. I feel like I'm doing a little bit of a sales bit. I guess I am. But it's just, I think, ways to go further with what we're talking about. And I just wanted to point out that there's various applications. One is around coma work and end-of-life experiences. Another is around trauma and abuse in particular. One is more general, called befriending conflict. And then the last is on movement and body work. So if you have more questions, you can talk with me about that too. Thanks.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. I was looking for a marker. I can't find a marker, but I won't.
Thanks to all of you.
Yeah. You know, thanks all of you.
It's really, really wonderful.
Thank you so much. I'm going to just say my email is pierre@creativehealing.org. If you want to connect, or you can connect with the Process Work Institute, and they will guide you. Thank you again, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to just ask before folks go, just a Maybe you guys did this before I got here because I was late. But who's in the room? Are we like students, medical professionals, just interested community members? Students? Lifelong learners? Yeah.
I work for the county too. And I just wanted to say thank you. The discussion that and all of the perspectives that I heard were helpful to me when I think about trying to do outreach for early literacy, because the things that you mentioned about trying to listen to a community, get information, but